Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner of PricewaterhouseCoopers, and today's conversation is about the final report of the Commercial Activities Panel. And our conversation is with Colleen Kelly, the National President of the National Treasury Employees Union, and Stan Soloway, the President of the Professional Service Council, who were members of the panel. One of the last things I wanted to get through on the sourcing principles was number 9, which talks about ensuring both quality and cost factors in competitions, which seems like a change from the current process. What was the panel thinking about here?
One of the terms that was used is best value, and that's a term that I disagree with, and not because I believe quality and cost shouldn't both be considered, but you're right, the current system is based on cost. And one of the concepts to go to quality and cost, of course, is innovation, creativity, to kind of raise the bar, which is a good thing. It's a good thing not just for competition, it's a good thing for the federal government. It's exactly what the government needs to do. The problem for federal employees comes in on creating a level playing field to enable them to do that. My background when I worked at the IRS was in accounting. I'm an accountant, I'm a CPA. So when I think of cost, quality, measuring things and making determinations on what's the best, matching apples to apples is very important. And one of the problems with the report as I see it is that it will put federal employees in a position where they will not be being measured apples to apples because they don't have the resources to put new technology in. They don't have the resources to hire personnel that would bring expertise or ingenuity or creativity to a process. And so the current process provides that you bid on a performance work statement that is work that the government defines it needs done, and then that's what is bid on by both the private and the public sector. And moving to this new process raises a lot of questions about how that determination will be made and what opportunities, what resources, what commitment from OMB and from the administration is going to be made to provide that level playing field to employees. And we were not able to get that commitment from the administration as a part of this panel recommendation. And I'm very concerned about it.
Is best value truly subjective?
Well, it's not truly subjective, but I think Colleen raised a number of other issues that are important and that merit some further discussion. I think, first of all, the question of resources and people is a critical question. And potentially you do have a kind of a dichotomy in terms of competitive position in a situation like that. But again, you have to link it back. I mean, these principles are intended to be taken as a whole, not as individuals. And it links back to the strategic mission of an agency and an agency determining where its resources are going to go, not relative to people or specific functions, but what is it that I as an agency really am about? What are my core missions? Where are my resources going to go? And one of the reasons that you see so much outsourcing in the private sector, company to company, is largely for the reason that Colleen just identified, which is there are many functions in the companies that are not considered absolutely core to their mission. And so they put their resources into those areas that they really do consider fundamentally core and not into those that are what they consider secondary. And that's not to say the people are secondary, but the mission or the function is. And I think that links to this question of if the government and the agency or the component does not have the resources to do what it needs to do, and if the resource owners have made a decision, strategic decision, that that's just not where we can afford to put our money. Look, we're in an incredibly constrained budget environment right now and will be for, I think, the rest of our natural lives. Then that does lead you to looking at alternatives. From that perspective, it's a fair point, but it's not really, I think it kind of divorces the best value question from strategic management, and I think they are linked. Secondly, there has been a lot of concern raised about the subjective nature of what we call best value contracting. Of course, best value has been around for decades, but it's really the last decade that it's become a major focus, and 98 or 99% of all government contracting is conducted under the rubric of what's called best value. What best value says is that there is a spectrum of strategies from what we call low bid or low cost, technically acceptable, all the way up to almost the exact opposite of that, that is determined by what your requirement might be. If you have a highly complex, new, never been done before type of requirement that requires unique scientific and technical capability, cost is much less of an issue than it is, does that technical capability exist? Does that innovation exist and so forth? It's a spectrum of strategies that you can tag to the actual requirement. What people miss, and I've had a lot of discussions with people about this, and they're surprised to hear this, is that the way best value actually works is that a contractor or an offeror, in this case even a government entity bidding, because in a public-private competition, would be told in advance when the solicitation comes out what the relative weights of different factors will be. So they know going in, and that cannot be deviated from. More importantly, in the contract file itself, when the source selection team is doing the source selection, they have absolute numerics assigned to each category, with cost is 41% and so and on down, from which they cannot deviate. So it is flexible and subjective from the front end, at the front end, to the extent that it enables you to devise an acquisition plan or an acquisition strategy that really links to what the requirement is. But it is very tightly bounded, and we have decades of experience with it, plenty of case law to govern it. And frankly, many of the issues that Colleen and others have raised were issues industry was raising 10 and 15 years ago, saying, oh my God, I hate, the subjectivity. Am I going to be just sort of willy-nilly shunted off to the side with no ability to, no redress and so forth? And in fact, it's actually matured quite well. And I think the vast majority of folks in the certainly in the marketplace, most people believe we don't buy in our own lives on a low bid basis. And A76 is specifically designed to strip away all of these things and get down to a cost-to-cost comparison. And I think that disadvantages the government. And frankly, I think it disadvantages the federal workforce.
But I would say, in response to that, Stan, that it disadvantages the federal government and federal employees if, in the end, the government is willing to pay more money because it's more innovative, more creative, it raises the bar, which is a good thing for the government. But if they're willing to spend that money to pay to a private contractor to do the work and not willing to spend that money to give the innovation opportunity and the creativity opportunity to the federal employees doing the job who have the potential to be able to do that, but the government won't spend the money on the federal employees, but will spend it on the contractor with a higher bid. That's where part of the problem is.
And I think the logic of what you said is clear. I mean, I'm not arguing the point, but I think the other side of this is there are many cases that I've seen, and I'm sure Colleen has seen, where the government doesn't have the resources and is unwilling to put the resources into what would be a technology or other innovative upgrade that would drive performance. It may also be a case, and there are plenty of them, where the government cannot attract and retain the people needed to do the work because the government is not, unfortunately, for a whole slew of other reasons, an employer of choice, which the report talks to a little bit. And I think the government has a generational problem right now in trying to make itself an employer of choice, which has to do with investing in people and supporting people and so forth. But what happens in many of those cases, what I believe should happen in a case such as Colleen's talking about, where it's the money doesn't exist, but a contractor can come in and offer something that the government doesn't have to necessarily directly pay for in terms of a direct outlay. For instance, cost sharing or a capital investment. We saw an Army logistics modernization or Navy Marine Corps internet and other cases where there is actually a leveraging of private capital. I believe that we have to be much more aggressive in those cases with the federal workforce because the realities may be that they can't get the resources. But we don't do very well by the federal workforce in a situation like that. We have done the best by them, frankly, in a case like Navy Marine Corps Internet or Groundbreaker at National Security Agency or Army Logistics Modernization, where in effect, the federal government's message to the proposers, the contractors, are, you want our business, our biggest asset is the people. And so if you want to get this contract, you've got to demonstrate to us how far you're going to go to take care of our folks. And if you look at what's been done on Navy Marine Corps Internet and on NSA Groundbreaker in particular, it's been extraordinary. And I don't think we do enough of that. We actually treat the people in the process as the pawns rather than the assets in the process. And there are realities. There are limits to resources, limits to capabilities. But in the process of trying to solve those and settle those out, we can do a whole lot more for the workforce involved.
Let me shift to some of the recommendations. The first one was adopt the sourcing principles, which we've talked about. The second one talked about public and private competition. I'm curious, what does the report mean when it recommends a FAR-type system for those competitions?
Basically, if you take all of those principles, the 10 principles, and as Colleen said earlier, there was some disagreement after we got past that point as to what the outcome was, but a lot of us looked at that and said every time we tried to align a process to the principles, it began to look increasingly like the Federal Acquisition Regulation, because the underpinning of the Federal Acquisition Regulation is all bidders have the same rights and the same responsibilities, which is really the essence of the sourcing part of the principles. And so it became clear that the FAR provided the framework. You can't just jump in and say we're going to do this under the Federal Acquisition Regulations because they do not contemplate a public bidder. They do not deal with the workforce issues. And so there are elements of A76 that you would migrate with it, whether it's into the FAR or a new A76 that is based on the FAR or what have you. But the whole concept was tied back to the principle that speaks to, again, treating all bidders the same and giving all bidders the same rights and responsibilities, which is the underpinning framework of the FAR.
This wasn't a unanimous?
This was not.
Is there more behind that?
Well, the FAR process has never been used for private-public competitions, as Stan said. And to merge two systems or take pieces of two systems is one that I supported from a pilot perspective. Let's try this. Let's see what happens. It's an unknown process. And rather than move full steam ahead and impose this on every competition and on all of the work that's being looked at for competition in the federal government, there is a lot at risk here if this doesn't work. So one of the discussions was about doing pilots on this, on the combination of some A76 aspects as well as FAR. But this recommendation goes too far, in my opinion, because it does not adopt the concept of pilots and just assumes that it's going to be okay. And there were even concerns raised by the administration on moving full steam ahead without having results.
I think the recommendation, though, does talk to a phase-in period. It's a recognition that there will be mid-course corrections. It also talks to the point that we've done 75 public-private competitions under the FAR through the depot competitions. And cities like Indianapolis and elsewhere do all of their public-private competitions under their regular procurement regime. So I think there's a lot of experience that enables us to move forward on a phase-in process.
That's a good stopping point. Rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue discussing the final report of the Commercial Activities Panel with panel members Colleen Kelly and Stan Solway. This is the Business of Government Hour.